If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Welcome everyone to this solo pad edition of the Completely Unnecessary Podcast for Tuesday, August 20th, 2019. Ian's on vacation. I'm Pat Contry. I'll be your host for the next 65, 70 plus minutes talking about things like the 30th anniversary of the Sega Genesis, the new Intellivision Amico trailer, a new Masters of the Universe series announced, my return to the flea market after nearly 8-9 months, a Q&A answer, Patreon poll topic, etc. What's been going on? The Super Nintendo book's being printed. That's great. They're hand-drawing them. No. It's being printed right now. I have to approve the prototype covers since the book is so big. They have to, like, mock up a cover size for some reason. That's interesting. I won't bore you with the details. But you can pre-order it at ultimatesnes.com. The NES book is also back in stock right now on Amazon, and the pre-orders should be going out this week as well to the people that pre-order that, and you can go to the same website, UltimateSNES or UltimateNES.com. I own both of those domains. Ha ha ha. Other than that, you can also pick up the digital Super Nintendo book as well for a price, and you can see what the hell I've been working on the past 2 years with my team. And congrats and thanks to them, my team of 10 writers / contributors that helped me put together the book. And I pay my writers, unlike other people that do their books on video games. I pay my writers. And they did a great job, and I wouldn't be able to have done it without them. I can't write the same amount of reviews like I used to in the past. But it's good to be at the end of the line there and getting another book out there. And I can't appreciate it yet because it's still sort of in flux. It's good to see my writers, the team, being very happy that the book is coming out, happier than I am, which I guess shows a little bit of my sociopathy, but also the fact that when you're so entrenched in working with something and all the time and money and effort to get something produced, it's hard to divorce yourself from it and take a step back and appreciate it. I think I will once I have like the sample in my hand. I'll be able to, like, that happened with the NES book back in 2016. Once I had the sample in my hand, I'm like, wow, this is a real thing. It's not real to me yet until that happens. So we're closer to that day though, obviously. So yeah, I'll have it at Portland Retro Gaming Expo for sale, and it'll be shipping out, to backers in October at this point. I wish it was sooner, but it's a big print run, and it went about 6-7 weeks behind schedule due to some editing issues, due to some things that had to be rewritten and other things like that. That had to be asset creation, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, nonfiction's fun to put together. And we'll see what the next book holds later in the year. I'll probably make an announcement on the next book, what direction I go, one of two consoles. It's like neck and neck which one to go for first versus the other. We'll see. It'll be a fun discussion. I'll probably have to ask on the show which one to do and put up a Patreon poll. No, I'll put up a Twitter, Facebook polls to see what people will be interested more in, which of the two consoles. So thanks again for everyone who pre-ordered, and it's good to know your work is, you know, your efforts validated, obviously, especially something that takes so long to do. And people still read, you know. When the first book came out, people were like, oh, people are going to want that. It's all online. It's like, no, well, this is original writing, and it's good quality, and it's good work from people that are very good at what they do, very good at that 16-bit stuff. Anyway, so today is August 20th, 2019, and that shouldn't be a day that means anything to most people unless you have a birthday or anniversary or unfortunately lost a loved one on that date. But for me, there's a meaning to August 20th, and especially August 20th 10 years ago. August 20th, 2009 is when I moved out to sunny San Diego. And it didn't really hit me until like a couple days ago when I was at the flea market. And I'll get to that topic later. That's going to be its own discussion about me at the flea market for the first time in like 8-9 months. What's changed in my life in the past 10 years and how I've grown as a human, as I've developed as a man over the past decade, and how radically different my life would have been had I not taken the plunge and taken the calculated risk to move out to San Diego 10 years ago today, you know, give or take a couple days for leap year. Yeah. 10 years ago, symbolically. Pat, you're off by 6 days according to the Gregorian calendar. Yeah, okay. Anyway, so in 2009, you know, it was the recession had hit the summer before. We just had an election. My job was running me ragged. I don't talk about my job too much because, you know, everyone's had bad jobs. But my office job was getting worse and worse year after year in my late 20s. I got the job when I was 26. It was my third cubicle job, second in the industry that I was in, which was market research. And it was fine for like the first year. And then it was like any other job where they decide we want to increase our profit margin, so when we lay off people or they quit, we won't replace them. So more and more work will be given to you. So in 2009, I was doing the work of at least two other workers, if not two and a half, because I was confident I could move quickly and I was efficient. And that's not rewarded in a lot of office jobs. A lot of times you're punished. A good company will reward you with a better position, or they'll recognize you, they'll give you, a bonus every year, or they'll pay you more. In theory, that's what a good company would do, to recognize your talents, but it didn't happen here. So it was probably because of all the crush of that, and I just started doing Pat the NES Punk videos, less than a year before I decided to move out here. And those NES Punk videos obviously were just goofy, and they were just a hobby, the Mario Ball video. Mario Ball! Who remembers the Mario Ball contest I did? I actually did the contest, and I think I mailed games to some people who won that back then. It was an experiment. It was just an outlet. It was fun. It was creative. But I decided to move because my job was just killing me. I could keep the job, but go from like a managerial position to just doing the grunt work, which I was doing anyway. I was doing both manager stuff and grunt work at the job. So I kept my same salary. They just sort of, they docked me like my position, which I didn't care. And I moved out to San Diego and I gave it a go. And it was the best decision I made, because even though at first it was rough and it was sort of like throwing yourself into a new culture, San Diego is a lot different than New Jersey. It cost about this roughly the same amount in 2009. Nowadays, San Diego is probably more than New Jersey by like 15%, 20% more to live here. But it was about the same back then, especially with the housing crash. Costs came down for across the board, across the nation for everyone. So I could afford to get the condo. I wouldn't be able to afford that if there wasn't the housing crash. I'd have no money. I wouldn't be able to afford the down payment to do that, let alone the mortgage. But I came out here, timing was right, and I found what I thought was going to be, you know, someone that was a true love, or at least some love, and that didn't work out. That was a relationship, but that's a tale as old as time. But, you know, I sort of grew as a person. I figured out what I really valued in life. Yes, the game's on the wall. Yes, I value that. But I mean, like, just personally what I value, the type of people I want to be around. I've made some good friends since I've been here. Met Ian right. Well, I met Ian before I moved here. A year before I moved here, I met Ian. But, you know, I cajoled Ian into being my friend. I persuaded him. And I've talked about before in the podcast how it was always easier for me to, it was always more difficult for me to become friends with a guy versus a woman. It just was, and it still is. So I cherish those friendships and the friendships that a lot of friendships from I've gotten from the internet and from YouTube and meeting people at conventions and colleagues, and that probably wouldn't have happened if I didn't move, because moving gave me sort of a not a reset on my life. It gave me, I guess, like a soft reboot. It was like a soft reboot, like Force Awakens. Got a lightsaber in the gut, but you know, you got a new generation of heroes, and it just I don't know. It was something new. It was just something new and different. And obviously, not everyone has that option, but it taught me that you shouldn't be afraid of at least thinking of taking a chance while you can. And that could not necessarily have to be for moving across the country, but trying a new profession, trying a new hobby, doing something, getting yourself out of your comfort zone. I don't care if that means even going to see like a movie that a genre you would never thought of seeing, or joining a book club, or you know, trying that spin class at the gym that you would think, oh, this isn't for me, or trying yoga if you think that's not for you. I mean, I thought yoga wasn't for me, and I started doing it in New Jersey before I even got here, when yoga wasn't really a thing out in the East Coast. I was like, eh, yoga, that's for girls or whatever. And just doing things to sort of expand your horizon. So that's the biggest, I guess, lesson or takeaway from the experience, is that the move literally expanded my horizon to a new coast. But it just, I don't know. I didn't want to be afraid of taking the chance and trying. And that was before, you know, YouTube and, well, YouTube, I was doing it, but it was purely a hobby, putting out a video like once a month or once every 5 weeks. You know, it was just a weird hobby. It was for most people back in 2008, 2009. You know, that was before I was affiliated with any website. I hadn't joined Retroware yet. I think, yeah, I posted a Screw Attack. I posted a Game Trailers, things like that. But I wasn't officially affiliated with them. This is before I went to any of those conventions. My first convention was Screw Attack. It was SGC 2010. Or was it MAGFest? I think was it SGC, then it was MAGFest 2010. So I think it was, I forget. It was one or the other. Anyway, but then, yeah, my life sort of expanded, and, you know, I met people, new friends, and things have been better. It's never perfect. Making a big change is never perfect. And even if your life is better, it's never perfect. No life is. But I'm just happy that I made the decision. And 10 years flies by. It didn't fly by for me. Oh, no, it didn't. I think there was definitely like a 2 or 3 year period in there that felt like it flew by, especially after I first moved there. It was like 2 or 3 years later in my condo. I was like, oh, wow, this doesn't feel like I've been here that long. It feels like a year. And it was like 3 years already. And already things had changed, and I noticed changes in myself and my personality. And definitely not as crazy as I was even 5, 6 years ago. But 10 years ago, I think I was more of a maniac. And that was because of, I think, mental health things going on. But also, my job was just, the stress was killing me. I mean, Ian talks about that, how I was like gray, like, before I quit my job. I quit my job 7 years ago, you know, working not just 50, yeah, but other people work 50-hour work weeks or 55-hour work weeks, but it was not necessarily the time, and the average is honestly probably about 45 hours a week. It wasn't 55 every week, but there was like weeks of time where it hit 55 hours, sometimes 60, and it wasn't the number of hours that killed me. It was the stress of the time. It wasn't like just like, oh, yeah, you know, it was like easy 60 hours. It was tough, like, crunch time, 50, 60 hour work weeks. And that's what killed me, and responding to clients on deadlines. Deadline client driven work is the worst of all, because like, it's not up to you. It's up to, you know, you have to do it. Like there's no excuses. You got to get the work done, or you're in deep shit. And that's what my job was, but whatever, it's fine. It's in the past. And I actually like a few of the people I worked with. Half of them I don't, but I like some of those people. I think I should go back to New Jersey and visit them. That'd be funny. Be like, hey, remember Pat? Hey, Pat, what are you up to? I think a few know that what I'm up to. They've gotten wind of it, or they've at least recognized me through someone. And I think I've heard from a couple people that, it's kind of weird that they know I've become. I think one of the people saw me on Pawn Stars. and probably looked me up after that, or saw me on Spike TV. Anyway, what was I going with this? I'm kind of rambling right now, but I just think it's funny that how much has transpired in 10 years. And I'm not the only one, but this is my anniversary date, is August 20th. And I'll never forget leaving New Jersey it was, I mean, New Jersey in August and July is awful in terms of the heat, the humidity. And that day I left, I'll never forget it. All my stuff was already moved out. It was on, you know, my car was gone even. This is before Uber and Lyft, so it's like I had to walk to like the local Chili's to get something to eat. And I think I hung out with a girl I was friends with that night, and I had nowhere to sleep. I had all my luggage with me. I probably should have called a, honestly, I should have called a, this is even before smartphones, 2009. I mean, not people had smartphones. Yeah, so I couldn't just like say, oh, Lyft, pick me up, take me to a hotel or take me to the airport, you know, the night before. I should have done that, honestly. I should have just went to the airport the night before. But I wanted to have like one last night there. I slept on like clothes I had that I packed on my fake wood floor in my garden apartment in New Jersey. And sort of just reminisced and thought, oh, I'm making a big change. Did I do the right thing? It was hectic to pack all the stuff and move it. Not nearly as hectic as it was a year and a half ago to move, because my game collection is like five times the size it was before. My game collection was cute and small in 2009 compared to what it is now. Jesus Christ. God, it was probably 20% of the size, maybe less. But I slept on the clothes on the – then my next-door neighbor let me sleep on her couch. That was nice of her too. As I said, I know where, you know, I should have just went to a hotel and done that. But I was like, something, I was weirded out. I was different 10 years ago. I didn't think as clearly as I did now. And then I never forget that morning when I got the cab, I scheduled the cab to take me to the airport, Newark to get me to San Diego, how awful it was when I stepped on outside. It was like 100% humidity. And it was like one of those things where you were instantly you feel wet and drenched going outside, like 90 degrees, but 95, 100% humidity. And I said to myself, I'm not going to miss this. And I haven't. I've missed the pork roll and the diners and, you know, the leaves turning color. I missed the fall season. The autumn is my favorite season. I missed the Jersey Shore, but I didn't miss nearly anything else from my time there. And it was time to move on. And I'll never forget coming off the plane. And the doors swing open, the automatic doors in San Diego Airport. And it's like, wow, it's like fresh, cool air with no humidity. It's like like an air conditioner. And I said to myself, wow, I think I'm home. This is my new place. I think I made the right decision. And I think I did. And I was carefully planned. And I made a business deal before I came out here that gave me the money to get the down payment for the condo here, which I never spoken about. So there was a lot of things that had to happen, like domino effect, for me to get out here. But yeah, I'm just grateful and thankful that I'm here, and I'm grateful for life. That's not something I say too often. A lot of times I act cynical, but I'm just happy and grateful to be in the place where I'm at. And thank you for following me along on this journey the past 10 years. I appreciate it. I couldn't be doing a dumb podcast right now and have you listen to me, unless there's someone for me to listen to. I'm not just speaking to trees in the forest, right? If you yell in the forest, does anyone hear you? I guess not technically, unless there's some squirrel around that's trying to get some sleep, or some bear that wants his next dinner. But thanks for being along this journey with me, and more fun things to come out in San Diego before I have that midlife crisis in a year or two, and then move to Wyoming, and it'll be Pat podcasting from Ranch Country, the Country Ranch. That'll be me with my horses and cows and steers. All right, moving on to the first topic. I'm doing a podcast, right? Yes, without Ian, who's still on vacation. I am. So this was news out of Missouri. Unfortunate news of what's probably going to be known in the future, or now, as the first major video game heist that has occurred. And this occurred with someone I just met at this point 2 weeks ago at Missouri Game Con. So it was Missouri Game Store Trade and Games had estimated over $100,000 of rare games stolen. Located in Fenton, Missouri, founded in 2002. Not shocked that something like this has occurred. I'm just surprised it happened this quickly after all the latest news in the past literally couple of months, few months. News of the $100,000, you know, sold private auction Super Mario Brothers, and then it was nationwide news with this sealed Kid Icarus for $9,000 a few weeks ago. You have a Kotaku article that I had a symposium on the last podcast for 45 minutes. And so now the average person, the lay person, knows that this is big money. And we are almost 10 years removed from the almost nationwide news of the $10,000, $9,000 Steam events being found, the boxed one that was major news when Yahoo did the article on it. It was an eBay auction, and they didn't know that there was Steam events in box that was worth that much money. It went for $9,000. Yahoo did the reveal on their website. The news article, all of a sudden, everyone's like, oh, this is gold. I wrote about it on my website at the time. All the scam Craigslist ads that came up across the nation asking for, oh, I owned a Steam events when I was a kid. Can you, if you have one, I'd like to own it again, or my son had one. So bad things happen, unfortunately, in humanity when news gets out and people try to become opportunists or criminals. And in this case, a bad criminal element arose based upon all this news. And the owner, Jason, from Trading Games, I spoke to him on the phone for like a half hour yesterday to get more background, and hoping that insurance can cover the loss of all these items, hopefully. Video games is such a newer market. When it comes to this, it's not like the art world or comic books or baseball cards or jewelry, where insurance companies have nothing to go on. They have to trust the people that own them to be the experts. We are the experts. The people that own these games and people that run these game shops are the experts of what they're valued at. It hasn't matured yet to the point where any old insurance company will trust that, oh, these games are worth $100,000, and they are. So I'm hoping that Jason collects on this. It's going to be a tough go to get even a good chunk of the money back here. So this was a planned heist. They stole, sounds like, only the safe, not anything else from the store. So they knew the safe was there. It was, I think, it was advertised as part of the store that, oh, we have our, you know, basically our vault of stuff. And Jason told me, like, he had done a video recently talking about, oh, he unboxed stuff from WADA, games he got back, and he put some of them in the vault, including ones I'm going to talk about, including a 9.4 sealed Bonk's Adventure on NES. So publicly, some people knew that this safe was there. They had to. And then it sounded like the joint, that's an old-time term. They cased the joint. The store was cased beforehand, and this was a team that did this. Most likely a local ring that had done other robberies or thefts. It's being investigated, but they knew what they were doing. They brought tools to crack open the safe until they realized they couldn't, so they just dragged the safe out of there, the whole safe. And the comment that Jason told me about was that, you know, it was funny, ironic, if you want to say dark humor, that when he first got the safe, the games that were in the safe were worth less than what the safe was worth. And this is how much the hobby has transformed the past 15 years. And Jason's had this store for about 20 years, the Trading Games. So, yeah, he sent me this message on Facebook before I spoke to him. The old running joke was I spent $2,000 on a safe and filled it with 150 or so games. And in early 2000s, the safe was worth more than the games. He says, you can quote me on that. The value on the list, according to price charting, is almost $85,000. But he said, I would never sell half the games anywhere near that low. See, the problem with these games, and I'll go through this list in a second, is a lot of these games are esoteric and sort of niche games like Atari titles that not a lot of sales happen. So it's harder to price games like that out because sales aren't as regular. So price charting might be off. And price charting doesn't include a lot of private sales. I think they finally include some. I talked to the owner a couple of years ago recommending via email that you should include as many private sales as you can, especially for rare stuff like NWC carts, where they may not happen on eBay. So the value on eBay is going to be a lot lower than because of the real market in private sales. So I think that's starting to happen. And that's what like price guides have done for like comics and baseball cards, things like that. They try to look at, go to shows and know what's happening with private sales as well, because that's a chunk of it, not just eBay. The big one was a Bonk's Adventure, 9.4. Price charting was around 3,000 on Sealant. Of course, no sales data. One with a grade over 10,000, maybe, but I can't put that in my claims. So I got more detail from, like I said, this was planned. They knew what they were doing. There was an alarm. They disabled the video camera. And they got in and out before police response could get there. The list of stuff, and the word's been out on this, but have to do my due diligence because obviously I'm also reporting on it here as well. The list of games was posted on Nintendo Age and I think on the website by Jason. I'm not going to go through every single one. I'll go through some highlights here. And they're all pictured. He said all the good news is that these are all pictured in here, a book that came out, Classic 80s Home Video Games, that came out, I think, over 10 years ago, that he took pictures of all these games. So that's all the evidence besides, I'm sure, for the insurance company, like taking, you know, if he had a video of them. But he took a picture of them all, so he can identify even all the boxes of these. These are all boxes complete unless noted. And then there's stuff here that's hard to find. Sword Quest Waterworld, a Quadron, Loose and New, Flat, Unopened Box, very unique. Gravatar, Gremlins. These are the ones off my head I know that are hard to find, at least even loose. Spy Hunter, Tapper, Cakewalk. Let's see. I'm not an Atari expert, so I'm probably going to skip some of the ones that are probably the bigger ones that are worth a lot of money. Frogger 2. I know that's a cart that's uncommon. It's probably hard to find in the box. Qbert's Cubes. Chase the Chuck Wagon, of course. River Patrol. Minor 2049 or Part 2. Didn't even know that was a game. Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Halloween. Those are tough to find. A few box Atari 5200 games. A couple of ColecoVision games. Here's all the NES ones. My audience probably would know most of these. All box complete. Bubble Bobble 2. Bubble Bath Babes. That's at least 1,000 right there. Hot Slots, at least 1,000 or more. Peekaboo Poker, at least 1,000 or more. Secret Scout, hundreds of dollars. The Athletic World Bandai. In this market, I have no idea. At least a grand for that. That used to be, $100, $200 until people realized what it was. But yeah, the Family Fun Fitness Athletic World's worth a lot. If it's a Family Fun Fitness, it says Bandai. I think he probably means the Family Fun Fitness one. That's a lot of money. Caltron 6-in-1, that goes for, hundreds of dollars. Bio Buffet, Bubble Bobble 2, hundreds of dollars. The Bonk's Adventure Water Grader 1, tons of money. Cheetah Men 2 is at least $1,000 or $2,000. Chubby Cherub is hundreds of dollars. Chiller. Color of Dinosaur, Wada Slab, Contra Force, Donkey Kong Jr. Math, and this market, depending upon the grade, that's even a bad grade will go for probably $2,000, $3,000 at this point in time. At this point, if it's in decent shape, it could be several thousand dollars for that. Flintstones Dinosaur Peak is at least probably $2,000 in the box. Little Samson, the same. Monster in My Pocket, hundreds and hundreds. Power Blade 2, tons of money at this point. Probably in complete in box, that's got to be at least $800. Snow Brothers, a lot. Stamets cart and manual in this market, easily $15,000, if not $20,000. Turtles Tournament Fighter, hundreds of dollars. NES joystick test cart, Wada Slab 6.5. Test carts are always hard at the price because they don't sell as much, but in this market, at least $1,000, probably more. The same with the PowerPad test cart. Super Nintendo, all box. Captain Novalin with slip sleeve, new. I think that slip sleeve is what will make that worth a lot. I think that's one that's harder to find. Gani, a lot of money. Final Fight Guy, that's worth several hundred dollars in the box at this point. Noah's Ark, the same. Three Ninjas Kick Back, it's worth a ton of money at this point. Let's see, and then there's a few other Sega CD games like Space Adventure and Snatcher. Snatcher at this point, $700 easily at this point. Easily. Then a few Sega Genesis games that are water graded. Starman, Carnage, Maximum Carnage, 9.5. Doom Troopers, 9.8. So, even... I didn't talk about like even a third of the Atari games. Just those NES games alone, eyeballing them, that's like $40,000. Right? Probably $40,000 just from those NES games, if not more. Just from the, the same events and cart and manual. I said 15 is probably 20. The other stuff is easily $20,000 on top of that. So $40,000 and then the other stuff. I'm going to trust him. I trust Jason that this stuff's worth easily $100,000. So this is a massive, massive theft. And what Jason wanted to impart upon me is that we're in a new era now where this is 10 years later from that same events nationwide. It was almost nationwide news. This stuff is now nationwide news. This theft is nationwide news. Every two-bit criminal, petty thief, is going to know that, oh, some games and some guy's random collection down the street could be worth $5,000, $10,000. Maybe not this amount of money, but they're going to think everything in your living room, in your basement, is gold now because of this. So the time has come or has been passed, and I've thought about this, but how many more games besides a few in my bank vault am I going to add? I'm looking at games on my shelf right now that I'm like, I don't know if I'm comfortable having those games now here. Because if people know I have these games, you know, am I a target? How many people out there that thought about security are going to get it soon? I'm going to have the security cameras going very soon. I ordered them on Amazon. I just got to put them in place. But I'm going to have the security cameras, so that's going to be taken care of as a deterrent. But not everyone can do that, or some people won't care. And this, the good, if there's a silver lining to this, is that obviously they attacked a more of a soft target. They attacked a game store. What if some people are don't think about it? Some people might try to attack or try to go after someone's home. They might think you're not there or on vacation. Maybe someone else is. Your loved ones live there. You have a pet. You know, you have children. This is serious stuff to think about. And this was a shocker to me to be like, I mean, like I said, I was thinking about it, but this would be a slap in the face to a lot of people thinking about, you know, now that the word is out that this stuff is valuable, people can, like, again, this could be your neighbors. This could be someone next town. This could be someone you did a game deal with. You did a trade, you know, you traded some games that came over and saw your stuff. Can you trust every single person you ever had in your house? It's one of the reasons why I don't have people in my house that I am not totally, totally familiar with and trust, because you don't know. You don't know what they do. Someone you meet at the flea market, you know, my condo, I had someone in my flea market, a couple of people that I don't know if I'd be comfortable doing that, having someone at the house to look at my stuff. I don't know if I can trust them or people they might know, or maybe they can even tell someone, hey, yeah, I was over at Pat's place. And that person might be like, oh, that's interesting. Where does he live? You know, so I mean, this isn't trying to induce terror or panic. But this is something to seriously consider if you have games that are worth some money out there. Where do you want to keep them safe? Do you want to have a security system or what is it? Like Blink cameras, or the Ring has a whole security system with monitoring. They're not even unreasonable. You can get it going for like $150, $200. You can get it going. And I think more and more people are doing that because it's more affordable. But now's the time to really do it. Especially if you're a video game collector, I think you should seriously consider it, or at least having safeguards. Hey, have a pit bull live in your game room, or Doberman Pinscher, or an attack cat. Why can't, if someone can own like a pit bull, why can't I own like a lynx, or you know, or like a small mountain lion, a dwarf mountain lion? I'd probably own one. A caracal. Can I have a caracal at least? Something that would induce fear and can mess you up a little bit. If you try to take a bowl bath babes or a Flintstones dinosaur peak. But seriously though, this is I feel awful that this happened. The safe was 500 pounds empty, 5 foot tall, 3 foot wide. The cops are amazed it was moved. This was a group of people. This was coordinated. This was planned. That's what's so scary about this. That's what's so scary. And you feel violated. I mean, that's what Jason said to me. Like if you ever had a home break in, or even your car being broken into. My car was broken into in New Jersey. I'm not saying it's the same degree as this happening, but when something you own or property or business gets broken into, you just feel violated. You don't feel safe anymore. Like that's supposed to be like where you can feel safe. You feel safe in your house. You feel safe having a safe at your business. You think you feel safe. You feel safe having the safe. Yeah. You feel secure, but you don't anymore because of criminality. Because of bad actors in the world. It's a new era. It's a new era. I'm not blaming the people spending a lot of money on these sealed games. It's not their fault that there's criminals out there, but obviously because of this new activity and the money being pumped in, it's brought a spotlight now in the hobby that wasn't there even months ago. It wasn't here in 6 months ago, the spotlight that's now brightly shining on all of our collections. and the collections might not even have your collection out there. You might have even a game's worth a few hundred dollars. That might not matter to a criminal who doesn't know any better. They might show up and just want to take everything, and then they'll figure it out later. Now, if there is a silver lining to this, I don't even call it that, but I guess the small silver lining is that these criminals are going to learn that it's going to be really hard to move these games to get anywhere near the value of it. Obviously, the graded WADA games, those will have serial numbers. So any collector that gets that's going to know that you can look up the serial numbers and know that this is not, this is part of the thievery that happened. It's part of the heist. But trying to move, like, these Atari games, first of all, there's not a lot of Atari collectors out there looking for these games in general. But second of all, any dealer, game store owner, especially in that area, is going to know that this happened. Now this is nationwide news among video game collectors and people that know that these games are out there. So good luck trying to sell, you know, the Tooth Protector's foam box and shipping box, and, you know, incredibly rare Atari, you know, game. Try to move that in that condition without the seller realizing where it came from. So excuse me, without the buyer knowing that. So hopefully you have reputable buyers that know that, hey, you know, this stuff is from the heist. So I think what's probably going to happen is this stuff's going to have to be moved very cheap eventually to either a pawn shop. But a pawn shop's going to be like, what the hell do I do with all this stuff? They're not even going to know what this stuff is worth. And so this stuff's going to come out. It's just how much time is it going to take? And what are they going to settle for? Are they going to settle for trying to move it all to a game shop for a couple of grand? With that, and hell, that game shop owner might pay it because they know the stuff's been stolen just to give it back. And I think that's the scenario that's going to play out with a lot of this stuff. They're going to have to sell it for like pennies on the dollar to people that know it's stolen, but that people are going to want to recover it for Jason. I hope that's what happens. Hopefully, it's not just thrown in a dumpster. That's not going to happen. That'd be a waste. But it's going to come out there slowly but surely, maybe in pieces. And it'll have to be, it's like counterfeit money almost. Like, counterfeit money has a value, but it's like pennies on the dollar. People know it's counterfeit. It's hard to move and to get rid of. And I think it's going to happen the same way here. But I wish Jason well. He's going to send me a copy of his book. I'm going to send him I'll send him for the store probably a carton of books for him to sell. No questions asked, because he was a nice guy. I talked to him briefly at Missouri Game Con, and I spoke to him on the phone. And this shouldn't happen to anyone, obviously. It's tragic. And I'm hoping thieves realize that this is a unique circumstance, and it'll be a lot harder to move these games than they realize. This isn't like selling a DVD player or selling a TV. These are unique, a lot of these games, especially how they're bunched. These are unique collections of games. You know, if someone stole someone's collection, a lot of people knew about, people know that, hey, that's that guy's collection. You know, they are unique. They are not unique in one or two games, but when you put together the set of them, yeah, they are a unique sort of collection at that point. So moving on, hopefully I don't hear about something like this happening again, but with human nature, it's almost inevitable. We have passed the 30th anniversary of the Sega Genesis, August 14th, 1989, in North America, and then in Japan, the Mega Drive was sometime in 88. We always get things later here. Oh, not anymore. Now video game consoles come out at the same time everywhere for the most part. But back then, you had to wait a year? You had to wait two full years for the NES versus the Famicom? Oh my God, it almost didn't come out here. Real quick, the Sega Genesis mini reviews are out and about, and this has a connection because obviously this is in line with the 30th anniversary. And I guess the positive news so far, the early reviews so far have been pretty good on the Sega Genesis mini. That the attention to detail on the actual hardware itself has been great. There's even a little piece to take off for the slot for the expansion port that you don't need to. They have the reset button and then the slider for the on and off is supposed to be great. We talked about the games before, the collection of games on this podcast. We talked about the games set is very good. So there's no complaints there for most people about what's included, and that the emulation has been done by M2, who worked on like some of the later releases on digital stores and on the iPhone. So the emulation is supposed to be a lot better. from what I hear, the sound is a little bit off. From I think I've heard the sound could be a little bit off on the emulation in terms of the timing. The good news is that that's a firmware fix that hopefully they'll release. And this isn't coming out for another month, so hopefully, I don't know if it's too late to fix it on their side before they manufacture and get them out there. You hope so. I was not sent the review unit. I was offered recently after these reviews are out, so I will probably be sent one. And we'll talk about it at least in the podcast. If I don't do a full video review, it's kind of hard for me to do full video reviews due to the amount of time and effort that goes into it versus my schedule at this point. But check out the one here listed on the article, My Life in Gaming. And I met those guys, well, I met them before, but at Long Island Retro Game Expo. I trust them. They are the authority here. They did an hour review of the M2 Complete Works that came out earlier in the year. Did they also do a My Life in Gaming? Did they do a review of the mini here? They did. Okay. So check out, I'll link the review for My Life in Gaming for their review of the Sega Genesis Mini. 70,000 views already. I would trust them in terms of the emulation quality and the audio versus video. Obviously, this is not going to be perfect. This isn't an FPGA. This is not, you know, an old console that's been modded, you know, to have RGB out and things like that. But for the mass consumer world, this sounds like it gets the job done at, what is this, $80? Not $100, like the disastrous PlayStation Classic. $80 is a great price for this. I wish the TurboGrafx Classic was only $80. It's $80. And the good news is that this is a lot more attention, detail, and care than the At Games cash-ins that they did year after year for like 7-8 years. So, I was thinking about buying one. Literally a day before, I was emailed saying I was going to be sent a review unit. I was thinking about buying one. Pat, you're a hater of the Sega Genesis. No, I'm not. The Sega Genesis is a very important, it's, you know, I tease the Sega Genesis. Very important for video game history, obviously. So I want to talk about, like, just my, first, why this is a Sega Genesis important. Check out the Video Game Years clip that was edited by, I think, Joe Redifer. I remind him of a couple of points that I'll bring up here that he put in the edit. But the Sega Genesis was important because we needed competition with the NES. We absolutely did. When you have a 90% market share, which is what the NES had before the Genesis came out, 90% market share for video games in North America. That's nuts. That means 9 out of 10 people are only playing video games at home with their NES versus, you know, an Atari system at the time or the Sega Master System. 9 out of 10. You had the 7800 come out in 86. You have people that still, you know, the bargain bin Atari 2600 wasn't even 10% at that point. It was gone. And ColecoVision was long gone and all that. Vectrex you couldn't find at that point, you know, 5 years after they came out, 5-6 years. But 90% market share is dangerous because you can rest on your laurels and you don't provide an alternative. And that's what the Sega Genesis did. Besides obviously being upgraded in technology for superior, you know, superior sound and graphics and having that third button that I wish they had more of. And yeah, I don't like that original Genesis controller, sorry. But they had this was the first console to have true arcade ports in North America. So Afterburner and Space Harrier, Michael Jackson's Moonwalker, that was a little bit different. It's a lot different. So I shouldn't bring that one up. But you had arcade quality games. Altered Beast, the Pac-Man originally, was an arcade quality game that you played at home. So first seeing that at my friend Billy's house, I was like, wow, this is something. This is a step up. This is the teenager, young adult console. So for that first year and a half, almost 2 years before Sonic came out the spring of 91, the Sega Genesis was that like, sort of like edgier arcade console / sports game console. If you wanted to play, you know, Pat Riley basketball, Timeless sort of baseball, Joe Montana football was a big one early on. That was what you wanted to play. The NES couldn't compare to that in terms of visuals and audio. Gameplay, yeah, I'm not saying, yeah, Tecmo Super Bowl is a great game, better than any football game that came out earlier on the Genesis. But people were like, wow, I want to see 16-bit graphics. That's just the way it worked there. And remember, this was a full 2 years before the Super Nintendo came out in North America as well. There was a big head start versus the Super Nintendo. So they captured a lot of audience. My friend Billy had one down the street, and Kevin had one. He also had an NES. Rich kid. Not rich kid, but his parents had a little bit of money. So he had an NES. He had an NES, Game Boy, and a Genesis. Pat had an NES, and he had a TurboGrafx that he had to win in a competition. So it was like, I didn't buy it. My parents would never bought me a TurboGrafx. But so the Genesis, I kid it, but you need an alternative. You need like the more adult console. You needed people to buy the Mortal Kombat with the blood code in order to get Nintendo off of their kitty platform in order to say, oh, we realize we screwed up. We're losing market share. We have to include blood in games and have violence. You needed that to happen. You needed competition to push that with the Sega Genesis. You needed to help innovation happen. You needed it. Without the Genesis and Mega Drive, maybe Nintendo wouldn't have come out with the Super Nintendo as quickly, / Super Famicom, you know, 2 years later in both continents, 90 in Japan and 91 in North America. You needed that to happen. And obviously it has its own legacy of great games that I won't get into, so I'm not the biggest Genesis guy, but hell, I did a review of The Haunting. Pat the Anus Punk reviewed The Haunting. A game like that would have never have come out in the Super Nintendo. Even probably after they, you know, allowed the violence to happen. It was probably still too out there and weird for that to happen, The Haunting. But it came out on Genesis through EA, back when they actually experimented and put out cute little niche titles like that, like one-off titles. Check out The Haunting video I did. One of my highlights of the Pat the Ace Punk library of videos. But it was a part of growing up, the Sega Genesis. I was 9, 10 years old when I started playing the Genesis. So I'm not like, you know, cute little 6, 7-year-old plucky fat Pat anymore. I'm a little bit older. And so I remember going to Billy's and playing, you know, Sonic we didn't play that much, but we played some sports games, played some Altered Beast. We did play Sonic, but we played like a lot of NHL games, a lot of Joe Montana. And we would be listening to, oh wow, Pat really became a man. Good thing Billy had an eclectic music taste, because he blasted Queen. The reason I still love Queen today was influenced from my friend Billy. Prince, NWA, and 2 Live Crew. So picture Pat listening to all these different, we'll just say vastly different artists. NWA, Prince, 2 Live Crew, Queen. And maybe some Ice-T thrown in there as well. I remember Cop Killer being played when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, playing Genesis. While you're playing like NHL 93 or 92, or what was NHLPA, whatever, NHL hockey. Playing these games and listening to that blasting in the background, Pat's like, okay, yeah, I'm trying to groove to this. All right, I'm not totally comfortable listening to this 2 Live Crew stuff, and Pat's only 10 years old, but whatever, it's fine. You know, Uncle Luke, whatever. And so I always relate the Sega Genesis to my growing up and sort of like puberty, I guess you could say, becoming a man. My voice cracking when I was like 12, 13 years old. Before that, I had a cherubic voice. Even higher before that. They wanted me to be like a soprano in the choir. So the Sega Genesis is obviously very important. The legacy lived on afterwards. We still love it today. And Sonic's still popular. And some of the games still get remade and updated, like Streets of Rage and the Wonder Boy series and things like that. A lot of the games have been forgotten or been on other consoles in terms of the hardware itself. That was a height for Sega. It was downhill from there. Sega CD wasn't the big bad thing that killed them. It was really the combination of 32X and the Sega Saturn coming out in close succession is what killed them. Bad hardware decision. Read about it in Console Wars by my pal Blake Harris. And then they tried to recover with the Dreamcast, but it was like too little too late. You can't come out with like 5 different platforms within like 6 years. You know, Sega CD and then 32X and then Saturn and then... And then Dreamcast, it's like, God, can we rest a bit here? It's just too much. Well, 5 within 10 years. It's just insane. Every 2 years, you have a new platform that you got to buy new hardware for. It's just nutty. God, And so people still clamor for another Genesis console. It's not going to happen, unfortunately. I'm sorry about that. It's not going to happen. Besides the Mini. So here's to the Sega Genesis. I always will associate it with Pat growing up and listening to NWA, and then Prince, and then Queen, and then Two Live Crew. And then what are your memories of the Sega Genesis when you were a child, and what do you associate it with back then? And I did play it a decent amount at Kevin's house. I played the X-Men game, and I played Streets of Rage at Kevin's house. Billy was more the sports games and the odd arcade port. That's what happened at Billy's place down the street. And then we played some street hockey afterwards, where he'd toss me around because all the boys on my street were older than me. They're all 2 years older at least, so they bullied Pat a bit. But I took my lumps. It was fine playing street football and street tennis, but mostly street hockey in the cold New Jersey winters. If you're still using one of the big wireless providers in 2019, have you asked yourself what you're paying for? Between expensive retail stores, inflated prices, and hidden fees, you're being taken advantage of because they know you'll pay. Enter Mint Mobile. Mint Mobile provides the same premium network coverage you're used to, but at a fraction of the cost because everything is online. Mint Mobile saves on retail locations and overhead, then passes those savings directly to you. Mint Mobile, they sent me a nice SIM card, and all you need is your own phone, your own unlocked GSM cell phone, and you're ready to go. You can be set up within minutes, and they use the T-Mobile network. So it's a nationwide network that you can trust as well. And so far, coverage for me has been great. So they have plans that start at just $15 a month for unlimited text and minutes. And then they go up for there based upon how much data you want each month. So stop paying for unlimited data, because that's where a lot of the high costs from the other companies comes in. You can choose between plans with 3, 8, or 12 gigabytes of 4G LTE data. You can use your own phone, like I said, and you keep your same phone number along with all your existing contacts. If you own your phone, it's most likely unlocked, or you can call up your provider who you got the phone from if it's paid for, and they should unlock it for you there so you can get going. Or, of course, you can always buy one that's already unlocked and ready to go. So here's what I want you to do. You get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month. You can get the plan shipped to your door for free. You get the SIM card, and you get everything you need to get set up. Go to mintmobile.com/CU podcast. That's mintmobile.com/CU podcast. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/CU podcast. All right. A Masters of the Universe series was announced. This was kind of surprising. At PowerCon this past weekend in Anaheim, my pal Pixel Dan was there because he's a big guy in the community for Masters of the Universe. He-Man, you say He-Man, it's He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. Masters of the Universe is just a name for the whole set of weirdos like Beastman and Merman and Men-at-Arms and all the toys I grew up with, and you did too, and Teela, and Evil Lyn, and of course Skeletor, and Orko, and what the hell was the cat called? The cat was always scared. Cringer? Was it Cringer? What the hell was it? I should know this. I had all the toys when I was a kid. It was like, I had He-Man toys from like 3.5 years old, until I was probably 7, and then I got out of it, and then focused solely on then G.I. Joe for a few years, and then transitioned out of that, and then Pat got too old to get toys after Ninja Turtles and X-Men and Marvel figures. That was like the main toys I had as a kid. But I remember going to Kmart, I was probably 3 years old, 3.5, and it must have been, because I don't know how, I talked to Dan about how many years they produced the same figures, but I remember my mom bought me He-Man in Skeletor. I said to my mom, she remembers, I said, I want one bad guy and one good guy. And so she bought me a Skeletor, and she bought me a He-Man to play with. I came out. I'll never forget that. It's one of the memories that makes me almost tear up when she bought me those two. So it must have been late 83, early 84, probably like 3.5, 4, that I got those figures. And I always loved the He-Man figures because He-Man, you imagine yourself being a man and muscles and steroids and... And the characters are so wacky. They're very specific. all the characters. Like Trap Jaw. He's a guy with a trap jaw. And weapons you switched out. Many Faces had multiple faces. Merman was a mermaid man. Beast Man was a beast that was also a man. You know? Very specific. Skeletor was a skeleton. Man at Arms had a... Well, he was a man that had arms. That one didn't make sense. You know, so it was very on the nose for learning about good versus evil. And I guess that's why it's most popular, like, 80s toy thing that's still going. I mean, they still make so many toys. Yeah, Transformers probably as well, but I don't know. And they've had the movies with Transformers. But He-Man, I don't know, it evokes something still with... At this point, you know, if you are a He-Man fan, you're probably in your 40s by now. You got to be at least late 30s. Because He-Man Zenith was like 83, 84, 85, and then by like 87, the movie came out. By that point, it started to die out. So early to mid-80s, let's just say 85, was like the top of the He-Man. You know, like when they had Snake Mountain and things like that, 85. You know, that's probably like the zenith of He-Man. That's 35 years ago. So you were like 5 years old. You're 40 now. We'll just say the tail end of the 80s. Probably the youngest hardcore He-Man fan that existed back in the 80s. You're probably like 35, 34 at this point. You know? So He-Man's beloved. And they had that series in the early 2000s that people liked didn't take off. And then they had the Netflix She-Ra come out that's gotten rave reviews. Never mind the fact that... fucking weirdos on the internet were complaining that the new She-Ra wasn't fuckable enough, even though she was a teenage girl. That aside, we have a Masters of the Universe series from Netflix that's going to come out, an original series. It's going to leave off where the original one ended, called Masters of the Universe Revelation. And Kevin Smith's involved as a director on the show, which shocked people that they kept this under wraps at PowerCon, including my pal Pixel Danner interviewed him. Check out the interview. The synopsis from Netflix, featuring fan favorites He-Man, Orko Cringer, and Man-at-Arms, the story pits our heroic warriors and guardians of Castle Grayskull against Skeletor, Evil Lynn, Beastman, and the vile legions of Snake Mountain. But after a ferocious final battle, forever fractures Eternia, it's up to Teela to solve the mystery of the missing Sword of Power in a race against time to prevent the end of the universe. Her journey will uncover the secrets of Grayskull, at last. This is the epic He-Man, the Master of the Universe saga fans have waited 35 years to see. So they're going to end the original series, which never ended. I think there was like, 60 to 70 episodes over 2 to 3 years. They did a lot more episodes back then, like G.I. Joe, like the third season, the first full season had like dozens of episodes, for example. That's the way they did it back then. They did it for like kids watching every day during the week, like 5 days a week for like a few months. That's how they made them back then, not just once a week. They weren't once a week. You'd come home and watch it, after school. Kevin Smith said, "I'm eternally grateful to Mattel TV and Netflix for entrusting me with not only the secrets of Grayskull, but also their entire universe. In Revelation, we pick up right where the classic era left off to tell an epic tale of what may be the final battle between He-Man and Skeletor. Brought to life with the most metal character designs, powerhouse animation can contain in the frame. This is the Master of the Universe story you always wanted to see as a kid." He'll be writing along with people from Supergirl, Reign of the Superman, people from Magic the Gathering, and others as well. I guess this probably won't come out for at least a year if this is going to be animated. Obviously, they're just announcing it now. So I guess what's not clear is that. So you have the original characters having this final battle. How much are they going to show up after this final battle? I think this is going to be analogous to the Fuller House show, where like the first episode was a total reunion where you had all the characters there, and then it spun off into DJ and Stephanie and the annoying neighbor, and just focusing on those characters, the female characters by and large. While the other characters were gone. This sounds like something similar where you're going to have probably a couple episodes to tie up the story, and then Teela's going to be the main character going forward. And everyone loves Teela. That shouldn't be an issue. I had her as a kid. The snakeskin outfit. Oh, I did something to 5-year-old Pat as a kid. Oh, look at Teela's long legs. They made the legs long on those characters. They you know, they were like toned aerobic women for us kids. Tila and Evil Lyn was the same mold, but Evil Lyn was yellow skin, a little jaundiced. But, you know, Tila and Evil Lyn, they got some nice long legs on them back then as a kid. You know, just saying. So I think that's the way this is going to go. You'll probably have He-Man and the other characters show up. But if there's going to be a final battle, I don't know. Is this going to be like how the Transformers movie had like all the robots killed off here and like willy-nilly? I hope not. I hope they keep the tone, maybe a little matured a little bit. Because the 2000, early 2000, was it 2002 one was like a more mature He-Man. I don't know. I want to say more mature, but you want the goofy family-friendly tone of the original. Maybe somewhere in the middle. I have the feeling it'll be probably somewhere in the middle. They'll keep a goofy tone, but make it a little more serious. Like if G.I. Joe came back on and they redid it, please have a new G.I. Joe series. It's been so long. And please have a G.I. Joe series continue on where the movie ended, because there was a plan for that. The freaking one, the Dick series stunk. Please continue G.I. Joe after the movie. Please. Sorry. I'm begging you, Netflix. Anyway, if G.I. Joe came back, it would have the tone of the original, but they would have it be more mature with more like Joe's being hurt and or killed every now and then. I think they would do that. We'll see. We'll see if Merman takes an axe to the face, or if, you know, Skeletor, you know, gets run through by He-Man's sword. You know, we'll see. It'll be interesting to see. Interesting to see. So I'm happy for Pixel Dan because he loves He-Man stuff more. I mean, I like He-Man, but he loves He-Man, obviously. And by the way, he's got a book coming out. He's got a certain He-Man toy guide coming out through Dark Horse, officially licensed, that he's working on for years with his partner. So I'm happy for Pixel Dan. And plus, they shout out Pixel Dan at this panel because they use Pixel Dan's toy reviews for reference on how these characters should look in his videos and soon-to-be book, upcoming book next year. So next year is going to be the big year. 2020 is going to be the year for the series. I think the movie might come out next year, potentially, they announced, and then obviously Pixel Dan's book. So I'm very happy for Dan. Very happy for him. One of the best guys in the world. And you know, this is like his dream come true. And I guess they kept this a secret to everyone. They announced it at PowerCon, and I wish I would have went, but I had to take a weekend off. I had two trips in a row. I was exhausted from Missouri, then from Long Island. So I was like, I could have went, but I needed to take a break and work on finishing up some details with a certain Super Nintendo guidebook. So, I'm looking forward to this series. I'm gonna binge watch them the same way I did Voltron when it first came out. I haven't kept up with Voltron though. I think they're like season 5 already somehow. I want to watch the first season of that. But please, Netflix, please, G.I. Joe series that takes place after the 87 movie, please. A new Intellivision trailer came out, a television Amico trailer came out. I'm gonna watch it on the obscenely expensive CU Podcastron 8000. We're gonna watch it here, and then I'm gonna stop and comment on it here as I go through here. Let's see, we'll do theater mode, I guess. We'll do theater mode. We'll put the volume up, pump up the volume on here. Okay, you ready? So volume up here. Okay. There's the Running Man we know about.
Our goal at Intellivision is to use technology to bring family and friends back together.
Okay, they've been pushing that. We know that.
Games these days have become so complicated, from the controls, the complexity, the menu screens. I mean, everything about it just screams, you know, hardcore gamer.
Well, I got to stop this. This is going to be a lot of the same messaging that they had before they announced this almost a year ago, or over a year ago, whatever. About they're banking on this family and kids familiarity, and this being easier than, I guess, systems that are out today. Shoot on your million hardcore gamers.
People used to play games with their families and friends all in a room together. And that doesn't happen anymore.
I don't want to stop it. It does still happen, but we'll get on to it. Okay.
People's fondest memories.
It's like a prototype.
Playing video games together is when they were with a group of people.
No, I don't disagree with, to be honest. Oh, you got some light prototype?
To bring people together. Put them in the same room. Having fun.
Can I say I love Tommy Tallarico's decor? I do like his throw pillows. And it's nice. I like the beige walls. I'm not even trying to make. I'm not making fun. Very light and lovely, inviting living room. I really want a living room like that, to be honest.
Communicating.
All right, different colors. We knew this was going to be a thing, and I don't like the different colors on the consoles, just because that's not what you should be banking on the interest on. It should be the quality of the system and the controllers. Worry about the different colors of your console after it's out first. I don't think that should be focused on in the video here. Different colors on the book. But I don't think you should focus on it, especially since it's gone so horribly wrong with things like the Coleco Chameleon, where they're like, oh, we have 10 different color shells and a clear shell. And it's like, that's not what the game console's all about. That's not what you should be focusing on. Like, the Nintendo Switch, you know, they had different Joy-Con colors, but the console was the same. Like, I don't know, it kind of just rubs me the wrong way.
Bringing back that kind of game night.
Simple games. Affordable games. Family? Oh, affordable. Oh, they mean the system's affordable. The system's going to be between $200 and $300, though, correct? Entertainment.
Playing games, having fun, no matter what skill level you are.
Motion-controlled recreational sports. So I guess that means the controllers are going to have gyroscopes in it, like a Wii motion controller or a Joy-Con. Recreational sports. That means like bowling, I guess, and golf. Party games. I'm trying to think what would qualify as a genre party game. That I'm not sure. I guess like a four-player game, like Warlords or something like that. Award-winning board games. Okay, like Monopoly, Parcheesi, Life. Is chess an award-winning board game? I don't think... Did chess win any awards? Puzzle and word games. Okay. Sudoku. That's easy. That's like an app. You know, that's, when I'm thinking about... When I see this stuff, I'm thinking about a lot of stuff that are apps. Like app-level games. Things like that. What the hell is that? Words games that... the battle with friends. The freaking word puzzle game and things like that. Professional sports. Baseball titles and getting the television baseball game back on there and a football game. Card games, solitaire, poker, okay. Action arcade, I guess some of the ports of arcade games from the olden times, some Atari type of games, things like that. Maybe a Centipede on there. Original properties, we know that the exclusive they have announced is the Earthworm Jim game. It'll remain to be seen how much that draws people to buy it and how long it's going to be an exclusive for, if not forever. Retro reimagined? I'm not sure what that means. Retro reimagined. That might mean the new games that they show here in a second, the television games like Astro Smash and Shark. Is it three sharks or two sharks? That they show off. I'm not a big television person to know all the other games they're going to show. I guess that's what they mean. Educational kids, multiplayer interactive story adventures. To me, that's like a point-and-click adventure game. That's what that is. Which is a good idea, to be honest. There should be more point-and-click games out there.
That's the magic that we want to bring back with the Intellivision.
All games are exclusive. Okay, all games. So forget about me. Well, I guess I said before that, yeah, even the arcade ports would be exclusive, so... If they did like a Centipede, I guess it'd be their version of it, I suppose.
Having fun. United once again.
Okay. I apologize. I don't know all the Intellivision games that these are going to be based on, but we have a bunch of them here ready to go. What the hell is that? What's that moon buggy game? Is that Moon Patrol? Is that a Moon Patrol game? That's Moon Patrol. Yeah, that's Moon Patrol. Okay. It's Moon Patrol. That's a shooter game. That's a maze game. I don't know what that one is. That's like a cute Intellivision Freerunner. That's a great idea for that, actually. That's obviously Missile Command, a version only on there. Okay. Is that Asteroids? No, that's like Sinistar looking. No, that's Asteroids. That's an Asteroids looking game. Yeah, it's Asteroids. Okay. A primitive racing game. A chopper game overhead. I don't know what that is supposed to be. Like a Desert Strike type game. That was Astro Smash, I believe. That's like fishing. Was it Fishing Derby? Was it Fishing Derby? Fishing Derby? What was it called? Not Fishing Derby. What was the fishing game called? Fishing Derby. Okay, a breakout game. I don't know what that is. I don't know what that is. That's like a snake game. That's Tron. That's Light Cycle Tron. Okay. Type of game. Too Fast. An Echo type game. I got some of them. Coming out a year from now. Over a year from now. Okay. It's good that they have games. We know they're making games. We know they have some of the old developers redoing some of these games. I guess it's nothing surprising that we're seeing. It's not really new information. I think I should put this on loop while I play it. No. I think what my questions are, they're not changed about, you know, being family friendly and having games that kids can easily understand. I think that, again, it's taken for granted what the video game market has become the past 5-10 years, especially with mobile and kids have devices in their hands when they're like 3 years old. They know how to use tablets. They know how to do things like that. And kids are pretty intuitive when it comes to controls on video games. I mean, kids use a Switch fine. When I grew up, I had no problem learning how to use an NES controller when I was 6-7 years old, and none of my friends and cousins did. And as things got more complicated, you know, we figured out how to use a keyboard. I was using a keyboard when I was 5 years old. I learned DOS when I was like 5-6 years old, how to access games. So I think it simplifies or it underestimates how much children can easily learn devices. Yeah. And in terms of the quality of the games, if these games are all going to be exclusive, if these are going to be simple games, there's going to be app quality games. And that's I'm not taking a crap on it. That's fine if it's an app quality game. There's a lot of good app quality games. But that's the sort of simple pick up and play games, like, you know, Atari and television types of games you're going to expect on a system that's going to cost $200 to $300. That might be a big ask. Oh, is this still going, the audio? That might be a big ask for people that don't want to dish out that much when they can just buy a Sudoku game on their phone for $5 or buy an Asteroids clone on their phone or free games on their phone. When you have games of, we'll just say, app quality of value, freemium games, free games, or $5-$3 games that you still have to pay for on a console that might cost you $200 or more, I think that's a harder ask for some people. And I think that's where the business plan flaw is here. Because why not just create these games and profit off the sales of these games without having to depend upon a console with a controller that looks like just like any like iPhone with mostly touch? And yeah, they want to put buttons on it and a disc type, a sort of touch device to make it similar to an Intellivision controller, but no one's clamoring for an Intellivision controller in 2020. The Intellivision controller design died out in the 80s where it belonged. Because a cross pad took over, because that's what people think is easier and more intuitive. And tactile buttons is what took over. Traditional face buttons and trigger buttons. There's a reason why controllers evolved the way they did. So I don't see many people clamoring for an Intellivision style controller 40 years almost after the original controller came out on a system that, if you were a kid when the Intellivision was popular for those two to 3 years, if you want to say that. The youngest person to have the Intellivision as a kid now is going to be like in their early to mid 40s. So is that what they want to share with their children? Or I don't like this. It's a weird market. I'm not saying there's not, there's going to be people that be interested in this, but I think they're off by about 10, 15 years in the demographics here. Modeling a system out of something that came out in 81, 82 when it was popular. A lot of those families are too young. So if I had a family and I'm almost 40, if I had a family when I'm 30 or I'm 20, I'm in my late 20s or 35, I'm too young for the Intellivision. And if you grew up with the Intellivision as a kid, your kids might be at college already at this point. You had your kids in the late 90s, early 2000s. They're off to college by now. So it's not for them either. So I think they're off by about 10 to 12 years here in the demographics here. Like if this came out 10, 12 years ago, when those Intellivision, you know, you saw the Intellivision plug and plays in their early, in the early to mid 2000s, those Intellivision plug and plays, that's when they sold. I don't think they would sell today. We've moved on from that, like in terms of the age groups. And that's not to say the product's bad or anything. I mean, that's just a reality as other stuff plays on the screen here that I'll have Kieran overlay with the trailer from the television. So you see what I mean? I just think demographically it's off. If this came out 10 years ago, I think you would have a shot. If it came out 15 years ago, I think it'd be a much bigger deal than now. Especially, again, when these are games that look like app games that you could already play on similar style games you can play on your phone for free or for a couple of bucks. I would ask, why should I spend $200, $250 on a console to then buy $3, $5 games I could already buy and play on a cell phone or on a tablet? That's all. And I wish them luck. I'm not wishing them failure on a project like this, but that to me is the reality of what this system is at this point. What they're banking on, what audience they want. Putting those things, computing in my PatMath computer, I don't see there being a huge audience for this. Maybe a sizable one to keep this afloat originally, but we'll see. Maybe I'd love to be proven wrong. We'll come back a year from now when they have a launch trailer coming out or when it's going to premiere. We'll see. At least they're not crowdfunding it and then, you know, waiting years and years like the Atari VCS. So I will say that. This is better than the Atari VCS on its surface. I will say that. So I returned to the flea market this past Sunday. And at the flea market, I hadn't been to the flea market. And I did a whole thread on Twitter that I'll link here as well. And I hadn't been to the flea market, I think, this year, in 2019. I might have went early January, but definitely for sure, I think I remember going December last year. I just haven't had time or doing working on the book. And just the energy wasn't there anymore. And plus, I don't film for Flea Market Madness anymore. I have about 13 in the can. I'm going to edit. Hopefully starting later this year, and then I'm going to put them out Netflix style. I'm going to drop them all at once. No, I'll do like one a week. I'm not going to put out all the flea market madnesses I have left until I edit all of them. That's my plan to do that. So what I want to do is just have them all lined up, edit them all like within a month and a half, and then put them all out. But anyway, back to the flea market. So I wanted to go back to the flea market because I want to see what I was missing out on. I wanted to see if it was still the same feel, the same quality, as and it was downhill the last few years. So I went back. I got there at 8 a.m., not 7 a.m. Beautiful weather, like 60 degrees, shorts, but not cold enough for a sweatshirt. Sun hadn't come out yet, so it was like the sun was out a little bit, but it was beautiful. Perfect San Diego weather. Best weather in the world. And then I found some stuff there that I was not surprised I saw, but not shocked, but in terms of game stuff, yeah, it was slim pickings. Again, I didn't get there until 8 a.m., but I was talking to people, even people that had some game stuff out, and there was not a lot of game stuff there. Wario, real quick. Wario was hurting. No one was at Wario's booth at 10 a.m., 10:30, buying games, where he originally had a bunch of NES games. He had just PS2 games. He had some NES games, but they were in the back. Oh, Wario, this isn't 10 years ago, buddy. The NES game hunt is not what it used to be, and especially at your prices. But he still has stuff for sale. I see it on his like
his acrylic shelf for years. He still had like a Dragon Warrior 2 that he had like 5-6 years ago that he hadn't sold. But the NES stuff was definitely not in the forefront like it used to be. It was like newer stuff, but no one was there. So what did I find at the flea market? I found overpriced Super Nintendo games, like a $15 Stanley Cup and a $15 Vegas Stakes. I found $5 Genesis games. Now, that's why I was kind of surprised that the $5 Genesis games were still there. This is how I know that either the interest is down or there's not enough as many buyers as it used to be. Because if I was collecting this stuff, like there was a Mortal Kombat 3, not an Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3, that's hard to find, but Mortal Kombat 3, there was Bubsy 2, there was a Frogger, all in box, complete in case, a Terminator 2 arcade, a Batman Forever, Street Fighter 2 Champion. They weren't $2 each. If they were $2 each, I probably would have bought some. But $5 each, it wasn't a terrible price, but I expected there to be less of these there at that point in time. Like, oh, Sonic the Hedgehog, $5. Maybe a random person would want to see that and buy it since they grew up with it. No, it was still there at like 10 a.m., 10:30, those games. I found a $5 Defender of the Crown by itself. I found my $80 Little Giant ladder that I was looking on eBay and on Amazon a couple days before for like $220, $230. I found it for $80. Ooh, I said, now I'm adulting with power. I found a few ColecoVision and Atari 2600 games no one cared about. A couple of ColecoVision games without a label, probably common ones. One was a Mouse Trap because it had the insert. I didn't even ask the price. They're probably $2 or $3 each. I found sealed 3M Scotch 5 1/4 floppies for $3. DVDs for 50 cents that 10 years ago would have been $5. When I first moved to San Diego, DVDs were $5. Within 10 years, it's hard to give these things away now. I found a stand of NES, you know, the bootleg NES minis with the 300 or it's a 620 games built in for $40. I found a stand for them. And I saw a couple sell. Found some starting lineup hockey figures. I bought Brian Leetch because I love Brian Leetch. Other stuff. TurboGrafx 16 lot. Now, this doesn't count because this is my friend Derek who knows what this stuff is worth and is a game collector. So we had a TurboGrafx 16 with three games for $150. It's actually not a terrible deal in this day and age with Legendary Acts, TV Sports Football, and World Class Baseball, but obviously it's not a deal. If it was like $50, that'd be a deal. And he had the video game preservers in the box I bought from him. And then I found some AWA Remco figures. That you never see at the flea market. The long rider, someone told me on Twitter. So like, there's still stuff to find. I'm not going to count the ladder since that was $80. If you don't count the ladder, because that's not video game stuff, I still spent about $25 on stuff. Is that an official flea market at that point? $25, $20, something like that. With the wrestling figures, $20, $25. So it was still fun. But it taught me the reason I love the flea market is I like just getting out of the house and having an excuse to go out. And you talk to people. So the people that there was like 5 or 6 groups of people, including an older Mexican couple that they love me. And it's funny because I always forget their names. They forget mine. But they told me how much fun they had on vacation going to New Zealand and Australia. And the woman came up and hugged me. She said, hey, nice to see you. Hasn't seen me in 8 months. Said, I thought you moved. And then I saw my buddy Luis and his son. Isaac, that when I first went to the flea market, he was like yay big, and now he's taller than me. Like 7 years later, now he's, you know, he was like 8-year-old, 7-year-old. Now he's like 16-year-old with girlfriends, and see him grown up before my eyes. Like he's like a surrogate son, and they're happy to see me, you know. And a few other dealers that I deal with, and I bought stuff from. They're like, oh Pat, good to see you. A couple of the other dealers I didn't see there, but a chunk of the ones I did see there. It was just good to commiserate. Even though, yeah, I'm a customer to them. I bought from hundreds of dollars worth of stuff from them over the years. But that made me feel good, the interaction. And that made me realize, like, I should go back just for that alone. Just, like, for the social aspects of the flea market I like. Even if I'm not finding the stuff like I used to, I think the social aspects I like. Now, I can't make a flea market mana series out of that. Just saying hi to people that I haven't seen in 8 months. But honestly, if I was filming, I would have been able to make an episode out of this just from the interactions being fun and not seeing people I hadn't seen in a while. It's been a while, but from the stuff I found that I thought was worth it. So, it's not the same flea market. It never will be. The height of the flea markets, you know, it peaked 2012, 2013, as I said before. Definitely by 14 it was done. We'll just say 2012. The first three, four years I was here. Not the same. It's never going to be the same. less sellers, less things to buy. And this would be a perfect day for sellers at the flea market as well, because it was like beautiful weather. Even when I left with the sun out, it was like maybe at most 79 degrees, 80 at most. When I was there, most time it was like 65 degrees, 70 degrees. So not the same. It's a different world now. Different world from where you come from. And Wario looking sad, trying to sell his stuff there. Yeah. Just not doing it the same way Wario, my arch nemesis. I don't know. He doesn't know who I am still, which I think is funny. Maybe that'll be the reveal of the last few hours. Man, that's allowed to actually interview him, have a heart-to-heart, and we'll hug and we'll swap kisses. I don't know. What am I talking about? Do you hear that hum in the background? My editing computer is on. You know why? I was done recording this podcast. I finished it up. It was all finished. I said finished twice. I'll say it three times. But you know why I'm back recording here when I should be eating a FlexPro meal right now? FlexProMeals.com/CU podcast. Save 20% off your first order. Is because of an announcement. When I see Sony trending on Twitter, I'm like, okay, what's going on here, Sony? Are you sold? Is the PS... Five going to be out in a month and a half? No. So it turns out that Disney could not come to terms with Sony to continue co-producing the I'm so flabbergasted, the upcoming Spider-Man movies, so that Sony has no deal with Disney anymore, which means that Spider-Man is out of the MCU. On future movies. And future... Yeah. Flabbergasted by this. Now, the terms of four were extremely favorable to Sony. So how it worked was they were co-producing the movies, but Disney was producing it. Kevin Feige was producing these movies. He loves Spider-Man, and working in with the MCU the past few years has been magical. Five movies: Civil War in 2016, Homecoming 2017, 2018. You get Infinity War 2019. You get Endgame, and then Far From Home, which is the second best Spider-Man movie out of the not counting the animated one, out of the six or so they've had, or seven movies. It's the second best one. It's made over $1 billion for Sony, and Sony kept about 95% of the profits in this deal. So they put up the money, which they have, to get 95% of the profit when they're not doing any of the work. They did the marketing and distribution, but none of the work to produce the film. That was Disney doing that to make sure they didn't F it up. So now they came back to Sony, according to these reports, and said, we will put up half the money with you if we get half of the profits, not this 5% garbage, and then we can also help develop your other movies that you're putting out, like with Venom, and all the other properties you have control of, like Black Cat and Silver Sable, which are owned by Sony now. And then Sony's like, well, no, we can do this ourselves. We got this figured out. Because you showed us the way how to do a cinematic universe using our character, Spider-Man, that we own, you know, unless you make a movie every 3 years and the rights go back to you. So Disney comes in, takes almost no money from this compared to what Sony gets, does all the work to reinvigorate a character that Sony had fucked up. How do you fuck up Spider-Man? But they did. With those Andrew Garfield movies, they fucked it up and had no plans for the future. Really, they had no idea where to go. We're going to do a Sinister Six movie. We're going to do an Aunt May movie. We're going to do a Gwen Stacy movie. We're going to do a Spider-Man. We're going to do all these different things. And then Disney swoops in and says, you know what? We can use them. Let's work something out. And so almost out of charity, it seems, you know, Disney did this deal with them. And also to make sure they use one of those most popular characters correctly, because they don't want Sony to screw it up. So, and it worked. It worked great for Sony and for Disney. And they can't renegotiate at this point. It seems like at this point, they're you know, no counteroffer from Sony. Sony could have said, how about we do 25% for you? No, Sony would rather make
you know, 100% of a shittier movie that they're going to put out without any of the MCU characters involved or any mention of the MCU characters. They'd rather make like $750 million 100% versus 50% of 1.2 or 1.1 billion. Which, yeah, on paper, they're coming out ahead, but then there's less continuity for the character. There's less interesting interactions, and then he can't go out and do those other movies. So Sony's just the worst. That's the only thing I can say. You can say, yeah, Pat, they own the character, now they can do what they want. Yeah, but they've been grossly mishandling the character. Going back to Spider-Man 3, where Sam Raimi had no inclination to want to do Venom. He wanted to do his movie with Sandman and the Vulture and wanted to be just like, you know, more traditional. And he was forced. Sam Raimi was forced to include Venom in Spider-Man 3. And you saw how that turned out. It turned out awful. And then when Spider-Man 4 came about, he was also forced to do things he didn't want to do. And so then he walked. And then when he walked, Tobey Maguire walked. So we didn't even get a chance to see, you know, a fourth Spider-Man movie done to sort of like wrap up the franchise in a decent way, which everyone was kind of on board for at that point in 2007. So yeah, we'll get another one out in a couple of years, 2 to 3 years. And then, you know, Tobey Maguire and everyone else can go out on top. We didn't get to see that. So they do this reboot in 2012 and it was all right. It wasn't fantastic. And then the sequel was balls. The Amazing Spider-Man sequel was balls. And they're setting up all this shared Sony Spider-Man universe. It didn't happen. But now they're trying again. You see Sony's feeling their oats with the Venom movie. And reportedly behind the scenes, according to a couple articles I read, Kevin Feige was helping with that unofficially to make sure it wasn't a total train wreck. Because he recognizes, hey, yeah, Venom, we don't own the comics, we don't own the movie rights to, but he's still a Marvel character in the end. So we can't have shitty movies. We can't have another Fantastic Four debacle happen. From 2015. Like, they're all invested because it's shared properties, even though they don't own the movie rights to it. So this is just a near catastrophe at this point. Near catastrophe. And I'll be honest, I wasn't the biggest fan of having, you know, Iron Man constantly mentioned and, you know, having to rely on Nick Fury and things like that. But not having Spider-Man at all in the MCU after he's been in it now for 5 movies already is going to be weird as hell. I was looking forward to maybe in the next Spider-Man movie, them introducing the Fantastic Four, referencing them. Because they dropped little Easter eggs in the last movie about Fantastic Four, supposedly, in the background. That's what I saw. And now that they can't do that anymore. This is just like a kick to the balls after what... I gotta stick up for a big corporate... Disney, but after they swooped in and repaired the damage Sony did to their own character they owned the movie rights to, and they couldn't work something out. They didn't try to negotiate. You could say, well, Pat, maybe they didn't want to give up 50%. How about 25% to make sure that this gravy train continues that Disney set up for them? This is one of the most peculiar deals probably ever in the history of motion pictures, where you have two companies co-producing it, but really one's doing all the work and getting none of the profits from it. Almost none of the profits, 5%. And all they wanted to do was say, well, we'll put up half the money. So we bought in, but then we get half the profits. And Sony didn't even counter that. Sony's like, no, we got our Venom movie. So now I got to look forward to a shitty Morbius movie that no one wants to see. Any other shitty villains. A Black Cat and Silver Sable movie that could do okay. I don't see it happening. And now we're going to have Spider-Man forced into these movies with Tom Holland. Forced into a shitty Venom movie to take on Carnage. Without any mention of the MCU at all. Just devoid of life. After, again, it wouldn't have been as bad as if we've now seeing what you can do with Spider-Man in the MCU, fighting alongside the Avengers. You know, he would have been fighting alongside the Fantastic Four going forward. You know, he fought against Captain America in Civil War. And how beautiful a scene was seeing Spider-Man. That's still the best probably on-screen live-action Spider-Man I know of, was even the Civil War one. When he took him on and helped bring down Giant Man. And, no, can't do it anymore. Just a shame. Just a shame. Sony being what's called Pennywise dollar short. They're thinking long term, not what's going to happen to the character in 5 years from now, when the next two movies don't do nearly as well. And then the casual audience realizes, hey, why is there no mention of the MCU here? What's going on here? Why isn't even, Happy Hogan's not even in here to mentor Spider-Man anymore? That's kind of weird. He's been in the other movies. It's going to be weird, man. Hopefully they can turn it around. Hopefully they can turn it around. Another note, sad news, this happened after I recorded. GameStop laid off 100 people, including half of Game Informer's staff. And I know we talk about GameStop, how they're not long for this world, and those predictions are all right. But Game Informer is actually pretty respectable from what I've heard and seen. I haven't read one in probably forever. And that's, of course, the magazine they give away for their Power Up Rewards program. And so that seems like that magazine is getting a heavy cutback, unfortunately, right now. And so just I wish they would have rather sold it, GameStop, sold the magazine to someone else that could to carry it on well. Yeah. I'm going to read about this initiative now. Cutting jobs. Anyway, yeah, so just dumb all around stuff happening with Sony and Spider-Man. I guess it was too good to be true. And I kind of sense something like this would happen if they had to re-up this all the time. Every 3, 4, 5 years. I mean, I guess it was a 5-movie deal. If that was the case, I wish I didn't put him into these Avengers movies. I wish they saved him for the next couple. They're supposed to have two more Spider-Man movies in development with the current director and with Tom Holland. That's supposedly the news here. Just not good. Not good. Oh, and they're re-releasing Far From Home with a never before seen action sequence. Probably the one they cut from the trailers in the bank, in that scene in the beginning of when they're in like the restaurant. That's what that's going to be, the extended version. Man, not good. Not happy about this. All right, then. Well, that's it for this news. So it's sad for this. Also, the Game Informer staff being laid off is very sad, and unfortunately, and. On that aspect, there's not a lot of, it seems like every year something's being shut down and there's less and less game news outlets. So it's hard for these people to find jobs easily here and there, because of that. So hopefully they land on their feet as well. In terms of the Spider-Man deal, yeah, I'm annoyed. Just annoyed by that. Q&A time on the CU podcast here. Well, actually a Patreon poll. You can go to patreon.com/CU podcast. You vote on the topic each week. There's a writing each week. There was Ian just, I put up one from him yesterday. I wrote about pizza last week. I'm starving. And there's a weekly Google Hangout with Ian. I think it's this weekend for him coming up. So the Patreon poll is going to be, your choices are, drumroll please. I should have this up here, but I don't. Patreon, what's my Patreon here? Post. In third place, drum roll. As I waste time. Third place on the poll. This is a bad week for second and third place. Third place, 9%. What classic arcade games do you not enjoy playing? Now, I put in parentheses, maybe safer when Ian is back with a tongue emoticon. 9%. That's a good topic. So I basically discourage people from voting for that. Second place was 16%. What would your ideal game collection consist of? A price was no object. Then first place is 75%. Has Pat dealt with troublesome folks or trolls in person? I thought this was going to win. I haven't spoken about this in a while. It's been a while. But yes, of course I have. It's rare, though. So I go to, since 2010, between 2010 and 2019, that's like 10 years ago in the conventions. The average number of conventions I go to each year is probably, if you some years is more than 6. The beginning, it goes probably less than 6, like 3. We'll say the average is 6 a year. More and more the year after year. My peak was probably 10 in 2016-17. 10 a year. We'll just say the average is 6 to 7. So I've been to probably 60 to 70 conventions the past 9, 10 years. I could probably count on 2 hands, maybe 3. The number of weird or bad fan interactions I've had are interactions with people in person. And that includes probably YouTubers or content creators that have tried to take shots at me, that have approached me in a drunken state,
or try to make nice with me that I didn't want to deal with. Or, well, not make nice with me, just pretend things were cool and they weren't. And I don't like that. When it's like, oh, yeah, you did a video about me, took shots of me, and then now you see me trying to be cool with me. It's like, nah, you got to own up and apologize at least. And some YouTubers have. Some on the phone or in person who have attacked me have owned up to that. Others haven't. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about just trolls or, they'll say, bad seats. And how do you deal with them in person? And, well, this has happened at Missouri Game Con. And this happened with someone that came up to me and said, hey, Pat, whatever their name was on YouTube, you know, I noticed that I can't, no one's replying to my comments anymore. And I think I might be blocked. And I'm, you know, I think you blocked me. And you know, and they were meek and humble, and that's usually how it is, especially when they're froggy online or on Twitter. In person, not the same. But they were kind of apologetic. But how did I respond? I wasn't an asshole, but I was firm but fair, and I said, listen, if I blocked you, I probably had a good reason for it, and you probably deserved it. You probably said something that was probably shitty, and you know. What do you want me to say about it? And you have to empathize with people, because you have to realize that when people are lashing out online, they're doing that because usually they don't like something about their own life, or they're feeling either bad about something else happening, or they're depressed. And I realize that in the moment when you leave a bad comment, that doesn't always represent you. It doesn't represent who you are. But it's still shitty and it has to be accounted for. And you should be held accountable for that. And this isn't just with me. This same person, I think, said the same thing to Jay from the Game Chasers, where he said, and Jay knew who this person was. I didn't know who this person was. Jay knew who this person was. And so he kind of called them out, I think, more on the fact, especially since this person who was a troll online had associated with someone else that Jay didn't like, that had taken shots at Jay. So Jay was like, what the hell? And Jay has spoken about this to me before, about people that have come up to him that try to apologize to him. And Jay's like been less, we'll just say less friendly than me, where Jay's been like, you had a problem with me, you want to take it outside? Because I know who you are. I know you've attacked me. And that's how Jay is. Jay's real. Jay is like me. We're real. Who we are online is who we are in person for the most part. But I didn't do that. I never threatened to fight someone that came up to me. Now, that might be different with a content creator that takes shots at me and Ian, that if I see in person, I'll probably ask, hey, is this a mutual combat state? Oh, is it? Oh, let's do this then. Why not? You definitely have a problem with me. So let's settle it one way or the other. But for a troll or someone who is a fan and made a bad comment, or someone who follows her, no, I would never do that. I wouldn't be that, unless I did something very heinous, but that'd be really cross the line. Something like that. But with this person, I just sort of like shrugged and said, you know, I appreciate you watching my stuff, but no, I'm not on the time to unban you. I'm not going to go look that up, but you know, that's just a consequence of being a dick online. I'm sorry. 99.9% of interactions are good. And that's why I say about the type of people that exist in the online world. A lot of the people leaving shitty comments and trying to be trolls, trying to get a rise out of you, those aren't the type of people to get out of the house to go to an event. Or if they are, they won't in person act the same way. It's totally a power trip for them to do that, because in their own lives, they feel powerless, or they don't like their job, or maybe they have a shitty relationship, or maybe they don't have a girlfriend or someone they can talk to, or they don't have any friends. You know, so that's their way of lashing out and trying to feel good about themselves and putting themselves over at the expense of someone else. I totally get that. That's psychology 101. The same with content creators that come after people sometimes. The same exact thing. They're miserable people, a lot of them. They hate things about themselves. They wish they can change what they can't, or unwilling to face the risk of changing it, or admitting that there's problems with themselves. I totally get that. But in person, it never happens, because the type of people that want to come out want to have fun, and they're friendly, and they want the joy of interacting with people, and knowing that deep down we should be seeking the warmth of others and the friendship of going to the flea market and being happy to see people and to interact. And when you're online, being a keyboard warrior, that's not who you are at that point in time. So those people don't come out to these conventions by and large. It's very rare where I have these interactions with troublesome folks. There's been a couple of drunk people I had to deal with. One person 7 years ago I had to deal with, where they sort of got in my face, and I had to had to yell at them, but I would have yelled at them in 2019. I'm a little more stable now, but they got in my face when they were drunk. But whatever. Like I said, that's extremely rare. Hasn't happened in a while, something like that happened. So that's how I deal with the troublesome people. You try to show empathy, but you be firm, but fair. But you don't back down either. If someone did something shitty to you, you don't give them a free pass. And that's where I come from. That's how I grew up. It's not necessarily a Jersey thing. That's just being a man of honor. It's like, oh, you did something crappy. You got to apologize, or you got to show that you're a different person now. And then we can be good. If not, hey, I got to deal with you. It's just the way it works. So that was my Patreon poll topic. Thanks for voting. And then Ian will be back next week to take shots at me and yell at Pat. And I love Ian. It's a better podcast with Ian, isn't it? I hope so. Is that it for the CU podcast? How many topics have I had? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, that's it for the CU podcast. I'm done. You can follow. You can listen to this podcast on Podbean, Google, Stitcher, wherever they have podcasts, iTunes. Patreon.com/CU podcast. You can pre-order a certain Super Nintendo guidebook at ultimatesnes.com, or you can buy the digital one, which is out now. And of course, the NES one's back in stock. Yay! Back in stock. Yay, NES book. And those are going out to backers, or pre-orders are going out this week as well. So, for a big plush Mario, I am Pat Contry. Thanks so much for listening to my solo inane rambling. I will see you next week.